Hey, welcome everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd. I'm founder and CEO of the City's First Advisors and Podcast. And today we are switching to a webinar format, a live stream webinar on LinkedIn. And I'm very pleased to have a collection of some of the leading experts in autonomous vehicles and autonomy in general, as well as future of mobility. This session is essentially titled AVs and the Future of Mobility. And it is sponsored by UMX, powered by EIT Urban Mobility. Whether you're a professional or a student, UMX makes it easy to upskill and reskill in urban mobility. Dive into their free self-paced online courses, explore expert-led videos and webinars, or go deeper into in-person programs across Europe. And you can check them out at www.urbanmobilitycourses.eu and follow them on LinkedIn for the latest in urban mobility learning. And with that, I would like to welcome all of my three esteemed guests. First, we have Henriette Cornett, who's the CEO of Urban Innovate in San Francisco, California, my home state. Welcome, Henriette.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
Yes. It's kind of a reunion of the UITP summit last week in Hamburg, of course, for everyone
Indeed,
who knows.
indeed.
We just brought it virtual on different continents. Next but not least, we have Sascha Meyer, who is CEO of Moya, also in Germany. Welcome, Sascha.
Thanks for having me.
Excited. And then finally, we have Javier Guimara Tena, who is, I believe you're Spanish, but you're based in Paris and you're the head of autonomous vehicles at Padam Mobility. So we're really excited to have you here as well, Javier.
Thank you for the invitation.
Great. So, as everyone's kind of used to our format, this is going to be quite interactive. We have an agenda for about 40 minutes or so of a few topics that we'll just kind of pose to the different panelists. It would be a nice exchange and hopefully we can get some really interesting insights related to what's in the past, what's current, and what's on the future horizon for autonomous vehicles, and what's near and dear to my heart and kind of the brand of my own platform, which is Cities First. So how do AVs fit into cities? That's really what I'd like to kind of focus on and see if we can kind of gain some new insights. So with that, I think we'll just kick this off and get started. And the first topic I'd like to present, and all three of you will have kind of an opportunity to join in. Maybe we'll start with you, Henriette. What role will autonomous vehicles play in the future of sustainable urban transport?
Yeah, great first question to start this webinar. Very kind of the ambitious one, and something I've been working on for many years when I started about the topic of autonomous mobility in Singapore, actually, because this looked of a way to integrate the technology within public transport system. And for me, it's all this technology and the impact, the positive impact that it can have on city, is through public transportation, definitely. And the way I like to see it, if I make a very like a shortcut, is the technology can improve the attractiveness of public transport and make a better service for the people. And after, if you look, that's the kind of the end goal. But behind the scenes, there are many reasons for that, because it can make the total cost of operation lower. It can make like the service more efficient. You can have more flexible service for the people, safer in a way. So this is something we can discuss together a bit more. And in general, for me, the most important topic here is really reduce car dependency in cities and make sure that you have this attractive system. And so the technology is really just a mean to have this performing public transport. And with a performing public transport, you can reach sustainable goals in your city. So that's the way I like to frame it.
Move to shared mobility, of course. Sasha, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I hop on the same bandwagon with the argumentation. I think some of you might be aware that Moya is an operator in the on-demand field with more than 500 vehicles since 2019 in Hamburg. And so, being an operator and being responsible for the optimization of the whole business case, we know what the constraints of day-to-day operations is while operating with human drivers. And I think, as many people would expect, the cost of the autonomous vehicles will come down in the long run, but specifically in the business case, the challenges that we have witnessed is around the inflexibility that you have to position vehicles, you have to accept deadhead to bring staff back to the depots just for the purpose of them starting or ending the shifts. So there is a lot of inflexibility that reduces the efficiency of today's on-demand transport systems, no matter what the operational area is. And with autonomous vehicles, we will overcome those kind of challenges, and ultimately we will be able to unlock a new level of scaling that will increase the flywheel between demand and the supply. That will lead to less detours for customers, will lead to shorter wait times. So overall, the promises that we all have been advocating for in the industry of DRT or on-demand transport, they will become available also in the long run of services. And that for me brings in the sustainability aspect, as those services will not be eaten by their own success combined with the commercial inefficiency that are more or less universal to the public transport services. And with that, I think we will be able to attract a lot more passengers on board the overall public transport system, because what we have learned is that there's one single use case a day that might break your whole chain of usage and brings you into your privately owned car. So if you have one leg within your travel plans, bringing kids to school, or be it a short-term meeting at the doctor's, going to a gym that is not well connected with public transport, what you do is you end up in public transport, sorry, in your private car for 3 or 4 or 5 trips a day, while having just one more flexible option with an autonomous on-demand transport brings you in the public transport system for all your commute.
Yeah, that's really important. That linkage concept, when we break one of the linkages, certainly as we Americans are familiar with, it's our baseline is the single automobile. So any friction in that experience defaults us North Americans to the baseline. So we have to make it as appealing as possible so that we can match our sustainability goals, or as we have in Europe, the document that is near and dear to my heart, the SUMP, the Sustainable Urban Mobility Plan, which is the guidepost for everything we're talking about. So I think that's most important, whether it's a digital or physical infrastructure enabler that affects a sustainable modal shift. And this is one of the promises that we're speaking about today. So Javier, care to share with us some of your insights on this topic?
Yeah, so as I see it, a sustainable city, it's a city that proposes sustainable transport, or that has sustainable transport in place. And this implies, in most of the cases, not having the classic private car ownership or having the minimum as possible. But for this to happen, it's not only about blocking some streets or not allowing the vehicles to get into the city. It's about proposing alternatives that can make people find the solution to their needs on these other alternatives. We've been providing in cities for many years buses, metros, tramways, so all the classic transport modes. But at some point, we need something as flexible, as comfortable, as available as a private car, to be able to replace the need, to replace the answer to the need that people is having on the cities. And I think that's the role autonomous vehicles can play in us in the urban mobility. As Sasha said, we also in Padam we provide on-demand transport solutions. So it's taking cars, understanding what people need, and creating the most optimized routes for each one of the cars, so the buses, the shuttles. But these routes are dynamic. We put people together. And at some point, you need an important amount of vehicles to provide a good service in a city. And the more vehicles you need, the more drivers you need. And today, we will have this amount of drivers available, and the operational cost sometimes is too high to deploy the on-demand service you should be deploying. So I think autonomous vehicles can help provide this service that can complete what's happening on the what's needed on the city. So I think it's a key element to be able to take away the cars, the private cars from the cities.
Yeah, right. And certainly, as we think of shared autonomy and integrations with the backbone of public transport and complementing the original use cases, as we mentioned, both you and Sasha and Henriette all have vast experience in DRT, or as we Americans call it, microtransit. Two different terminologies for the same concept. One is European, one's North American, and really positioning that even stronger for a complement to middle to well-performing fixed route services. Albeit that is an Achilles heel in North America, and we see certain services that have shifted more completely to on-demand, whether or not they have an autonomous component or not. We are certainly going through a period of transformation, and this is a perfect opportunity for us to kind of strengthen the value proposition as autonomy and DRT can help complement and strengthen and serve as a feeder to target transit deserts, areas of low density in suburban districts, as well as a feeder to weller performing fixed route lines, whether it's here in Lisbon, Berlin, throughout Europe. So I think it's a very interesting time, and we're definitely evolving into the next phase. So I think I really appreciate these insights. So the next question back to you, Henriette, is about, let's see here, lessons learned. So a topic that I pontificate, I focus on a lot, for better or worse, which are pilot projects. Or as we Americans call pilot fatigue, we're very tired of the pilots. And how do we move past that? So the question to you and for all of you guys are, what are some of the lessons learned from AV or shared AV pilot programs and operational deployments? Let's say starting around, do a little timeline here, starting around peak 2017, 2018, before COVID, we started seeing all these, low speed driverless shuttles and everything at all the different conferences, whether it was CoMotion or ITS or et cetera. And how have we moved forward in the last 7 or 8 years from peak hype to reality? And how are we moving away from the pilot phase to operations? So that's for you, Henriette.
That's a big question, and I'm happy to make a link with the role I had when I was in Europe. I was working for UATP, for the International Association of Public Transport, and I had the privilege, it felt really like a privilege, to coordinate one of the largest European-funded projects by then. The name was SHOW, and it was about really deploying these vehicles that you mentioned, the shuttles, in 15 cities around Europe. So as such, it was huge because the number of vehicles itself, it was like 70 vehicles with diverse form factors, being many shuttles, but there were some buses, some automated buses, and also some retrofitted passenger cars. So there was this diversity of vehicles being deployed. And even if 70 doesn't sound a lot, it was a lot because there were so many countries and so many cities involved. And what this pilot project, even if, yes, we had the struggle with the shuttles that we all know about, them being maybe too slow or too reactive, have this harsh braking, et cetera, and the technical development maybe was not there, could not meet our expectation fully. But I like to acknowledge the work that has been done by all these players for several reasons. One of them is the discussion with the cities that happened, and this podcast focus on or this webinar focused on cities. It was a start for the stakeholder there, for the local agencies, to think about what they want and what they can do with this type of technology. So fantastic on this level. There was also the permit process they had to go through. That was also very insightful for them to notice, you will need some at the start, some exemption, et cetera. And through this pilot project, the discussions around regulatory aspects and harmonization, which the European Commission is working on, and I'm supporting them as an external expert on harmonizing some of their regulation. It's also because of this pilot project. It's because cities and a governmental agency started thinking about it. So that's one aspect. Another aspect that I want to mention, beyond the getting a bit like having a start of a momentum, like going and testing things, which I get it when you say like the fatigue. I think we have them all, and we kind of want to scale and want to see something bigger happening. I really like that this, so what I acknowledge, like to acknowledge for these shuttles, is they created a mental model in the mind of people of having automated mobility connected with shared mobility. And like something very similar to what we know from public transport. Whereas in the US, with the robotaxi being all over the place and many areas here in San Francisco, I'm afraid like people will think quicker that automation is something you see on passenger cars being Waymo, and now it will be even more confusing with Tesla, with all the announcements and see what we see around. So that's my like the big how I was grateful, so to say, in a sense, of this pilot project happening and the European Commission funding this project, is to have discussions ongoing about regulation and making it clear to the people what could be the future. Technology still need to come, but maybe we may talk about that in a separate question.
Yeah, that's great. Sasha, I'll have you answer this. But Henriette, yeah, I think it's interesting the perspective of the cities, the regulatory environment here in Europe, and your role at UITP, strengthening and taking a very methodical step-by-step approach to implementing pilots and taking kind of this iterative feedback loop and learning as you go, kind of a trial and error. And maybe we're not ready to jump right into operational phase. You remember, we Americans are a little impatient. We like to jump right to, step five, and taking a few interim steps and understanding the built environment, understanding the regulatory complexity, and with a clear aim towards shared and sustainable mobility, so that we don't have the dilemma of robo-taxis and just replacing a driver car with a driverless car, and we're not getting any automobiles off our freeways or our highways, which is not solving any problems at all. That is, I think, core to this understanding of this slow inertia, but this, let's say, ship that's moving in the positive direction, but with a few setbacks and a few different surprises. But I believe that at least here in Europe, on this side of the Atlantic, we're seeing much more collaboration again now with the public authorities. A lot of great stuff happening in Germany and Bavaria and other places. So that has me very encouraged that we are headed in the right direction. But yeah,
It's
Sasha.
unique. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So Sasha, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, on the TERT pilots with human driver, I think the main challenge was that they were all eaten by their own success. What do I mean by that? The services were highly attractive, and due to political understanding of price design, the services usually were super cheap, at least in Europe and most of the areas that we did investigate. And so this created huge demand. Most of the time due to bad marketing that was used. Marketing was often forgotten to introduce the service, explain the benefits to the consumers. But once the services were adopted by fractions of the population in the community, then it became an unstoppable wildfire. And what happened for most of the services is that the funding was not sufficient enough to scale. And this created unreliable services. And if there's one thing that mobility, specifically shared mobility, needs to be, then first of all, it's reliable. If you don't get a ride within 20, 30 minutes, then you just don't use this service. You try it two or three times and then the app is deleted. And so what has happened is a negative selection. So that's the people who had useful cases for using such on-demand services. They were pushed out. And in a lot of cases, it became a mode of transport to replace taxi for youngsters. That's a common pattern that we were able to witness here in the region. And I think that brings us to what is the challenges of pilots. Is that they are pilots. They're just too short to measure reasonable results. So people get asked after 1 year, how many trips did you replace? And could we get rid of cars on the street? But all the effects are so neglectable that you can't measure them appropriately. The next thing is that the services were just not funded to be sustained, and the overall service quality becomes insufficient. And the third thing is that the commercial pricing was neglected in most of the areas due to the fact that they were publicly funded and considered as being just a little bit a comfortable bus. Yeah, and with that, they were just too cheap to get into any area where they would commercially be sustainable. So I think that's the real challenge. There's the German or Austrian anthroposophist Robert Steiner, Rudolf Steiner, who has this famous saying, sustainability is if you think about the end at the beginning. And I think that's the real challenge with the pilots, that you just look at the beginning and say, okay, what's necessary to get started, get a few vehicles here and there, but you don't see where will this lead us, how will success look like, and how will we be able to deal with that. And I think that's what we can learn for the now upcoming adoption with autonomous vehicles. Now the technology is getting ready, and some of the industry players are open to bring this technology not only into the robotaxi market but also in the public transport market. And now we see the need for lighthouses, not pilots. We need lighthouses with large deployments, with the clear potential to become sustainable, to be able to scale to a level where you can be ready to measure the impact of such services over a longer stretch of time. So not only a few months, this needs to be sustainable for years, because we all know that traffic patterns, they are long-learned behavior, and it definitely takes a while until we see the benefits for the cities to come. So our call is to not spread pilots across the whole map of any state or nation. Make sure that you concentrate the efforts, make it attractive for the industry, and think about the sustainability on how you're going to prevail in scale.
Great insights, and I love the quotes. I need to connect with your colleague. We'd have a great conversation, because this is what I advise my clients to at Cities First: is think about your desired end state, think about what it is, your outcome, and work backwards. Whether it's the data, the technology, anything that can support your business case or your project, don't just work kind of in lockstep in building a project or a value proposition, but actually think about where you would like to achieve, in the next 5, 10 years, and then decide on what complements that, whether it be AVs, and whether it be future mobility. So that's some great insights. And Javier, what are your thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, so yeah, I agree on what you said before, that there's a fatigue on pilots. It's also something that we can also see in the projects we've been working. Authorities, operators, I mean, I think Europe has had many pilots in many cities already. I think they had an importance to learn and to discover things that might not been have been in the initial scope. So yeah, I think they had an impact, but maybe it's time, yeah, to focus on, as Sashan earlier said, on more long-term projects. Because a problem of a pilot is not that it's a pilot in the way that we are testing new things. It's the problem is that the time is limited in funding, and usually this impacts the time of the operation. So even if it works, it's difficult to make it stay. So that's for me, yeah, the initial comment. And then on the learns, we've been involved now in more than 7 pilots around Europe. And for me, the first learning is that the level for driving technologies, and that's the focus for the operators and authorities, is not ready 100% yet, and especially in Europe, but it's getting better and better. So since we started working on that till now, we are seeing an evolution. The progress is always positive. And I think that's good news for also the future projects where we will try to scale. Second, I also wanted to, yeah, the use cases are a key element for deploying autonomous vehicle services or services with autonomous vehicles. It's not the same. You can have 3 autonomous vehicles doing level 4 and working very well. If you have not identified the right use case, this might not work. So in cities, there are many. We usually think about a city as a dense core city center, but there are many different use cases, many different areas, and every area can need a different kind of service. And you need to work well, not only on the driving technology, but also on identifying how these vehicles can fit in this particular area and city. And third, yeah, then I think it's important that we don't forget, and that's something we have learned also on these pilots. We don't forget about the final purpose of these vehicles, and it's to transport people. So we have people on board that won't have anymore in the future a driver to ask questions, a driver to that can explain if something is happening, if the vehicle is blocked, if the vehicle is opening the door in the middle of the road. This isn't there anymore. So we need to be able to replace that. And that's what companies like Moya or Padang we are doing is to work also on these side services, these passenger services that should help the passenger don't be afraid of traveling on an autonomous vehicle. An autonomous vehicle doesn't need to be fun, doesn't need to be an attraction, but it doesn't need to be scary either. And we need to focus also, and don't forget, all these communication tools, cameras, alertings. I mean, there is a lot of things that sometimes are not the main focus of the discussion, and that we learn doing these pilots that is important to keep in mind.
Yeah, so I think we're all in agreement about the importance and the utility of pilots and the chronology and history and the successes. Kind of Henriette started the conversation with how they were integrated with the city environments and what has been done on the public transport side. We learned a little bit about the operational challenges, budgets, time frame, being a bit ad hoc in nature, being in a way that's a little bit difficult to scale. And then, Javier, I think you shared with us, how the technology can evolve over time to find a balance of safety, comfort. Again, yeah, it's not an amusement ride, but it's not a fear factor either. And it will serve a useful purpose within the right context, of course, and within the right use case. So I think that's what we're finding a bit more sensibility and maturity in this ecosystem right now, which is another signal of encouragement, I think. So the next question, actually, I'm going to flip it right back to you, Javier. I'm going to switch the order now. So you're back to back here. The next topic I'd like for you to kind of think about is around mass mobility as a service, something that I've worked on quite a bit in my career, and intermodality. So how does intermodality and integrating AVs into existing mobility ecosystems possible? What are some of the, let's say, challenges and opportunities in the wider scope of other modalities?
Yeah. If we focus on the point of view of a user, we don't see these autonomous vehicles as a mobility service. We see them as a way of providing a mobility service, or and the mobility mode or the mobility service is the on-demand transport. So it's on-demand transport that fits and completes these fixed lines around the cities, or when the fixed lines are closed, for example, at night in the city center. There is a way of providing ride pooling, on-demand transport that can fill these gaps. So you need to be sure that people is not using the service to compete or instead of the fixed lines. I think every transport mode has to be used on the right area. I've been working in on-demand transport for more than 7 years, and I always say that it's not the best transport mode. It's the best transport mode depending on the area and depending on the alternatives you have. And for me, if you find this, as I said before, these use cases, you find the place of the autonomous vehicles inside this intermodality and multimodality ecosystem. So at the end, we need people to be able to reach the services or use the services to reach the other ones. And if you are able to integrate on-demand transport seamlessly on a mass app, you are able to integrate autonomous vehicles on this mass app. Of course, you will have some features to build and some more more information to be shared than as I said before when there is a driver. But it totally makes sense as part of a bigger story. And we don't need to see that as an isolated pilot project. And even then, if we think about how people is paying for these trips, if we are able to really optimize operational cost thanks to these autonomous vehicles, you can even make people pay the same price they are paying for a fixed line ticket because they are not competing with this fixed line. They don't have another alternative. So that's the way I see it as part of the big picture.
So Henriette, what are your thoughts on this topic?
I will refer to what's happening here in San Francisco, having so many Waymos and so as robotaxi around, and they have been pretty directly criticized by the local transport agency here for like competing with their services and the way the agency see that here is they just for them a Waymo robotaxi is a ride-hailing service is like a Uber or Lyft, so they don't see the difference. It's just taking away people from public transport, having more vehicles on the road, blocking. They speak a lot about, and I understand that concern about like the pickup and drop-off point that maybe sometime like really not convenient for the rest of the users of the road, etc. And we haven't seen a lot of complementarity of the services with the existing public transit system, which is actually quite good in San Francisco. So it's not the same everywhere in the US, but there are some good examples in the US, and San Francisco is definitely one of them. But what I found interesting lately was a program that Waymo put in place last year that I want to mention because it drew directly my attention. They called it the Transit Credit Program, where they wanted to investigate what if we give a credit to our riders, our Waymo riders. We give them a $3 credit, which is more or less the price of a public transport ticket here. We give them a credit if they are dropped off at public transport stations, and they had a selection of a BART. BART is a local train here, but also the tram stations, and they wanted to see if the behaviors are changing. And at the University of San Francisco, where I'm an adjunct professor and also co-directing the AV in the City initiative, we interviewed people using this incentives, really using these programs to understand. So the big question we have is really, if you get a financial incentive, really, will you then take public transit after having using Waymo to get there, so to say? And the first result, it's very preliminary, so really a new result. So everybody will have to keep up and follow up to have more detailed results on this study. What I can share already is the way we look at the travel behaviors is we look at how people travel otherwise. Like without Waymo being there, where are they car regular users? Are they transit regular users? Or are they somehow in the middle? And usually people are, when in cities at least, are occasional users, potential users, etc. And you have all this category of people. What we noticed is if you are a car users and you rely either on your own car or on these ride-hailing services being Uber and Waymo as well, they would not change their behavior. They will still go to their destination with this private car being their own or a ride-hailing services if it's autonomous or not. If you are transit regular users, the behavior also did not change in the sense that people will use the mass transit after having using Waymo. And they would use Waymo just because maybe there is no first last mile options for them to go to this public transport, to the station. But more interesting, I found the people in the middle being the occasional and the potential transit users, because they kind of rethought of their behaviors and they kind of changed their behavior and did use transit afterwards. So a majority, let's say, not all of them, but majority. And I think that's where we need to look at is how to integrate the services to target also specific group of people, because we talk a lot of technology, of service, of business models. So, but at the end, people have preferences on the way they move. And not only, so we may have preferences, how can I say, like we may be more reliant on a car on transit, but we may be open to try new things and to change how we move around if we have more choices. So that's what I see with this integration in public transit system is to find the right place to put it and also attract the right people to use it. And I want to come back on something that Javier said, because I think Javier, you said something like, oh, AV doesn't need to be fun, but fun, the coolness of this robotaxi is a huge factor these days in San Francisco. And a lot of people, and from this study we could see, wanted to get to the public transport station to have this first last mile usage. Instead of taking an Uber, they took Waymo because it was more cool, more fun, and they like the technology. we should use that now. It may, maybe in 10 years it will be boring and nobody will talk about it anymore. It could be a good way if everything works in a positive way. But still now it's something very fun that people like to experience. And this incentive program showed that it can really be combined. So combine, and you don't have to stay in this ride-hailing services all the way to your final destination, but you can have a nice mix and have something, a transport that is more smooth, a travel that is more smooth for you.
San Francisco is definitely an interesting petri dish, having born and raised in California, worked in San Francisco and Oakland for many years. And just in terms of the built environment, to take more of an urban planning lens, it's such a range of densities and such a range of neighborhoods and contexts that it's really not one city. It's a collection of neighborhoods with a variety of geographical settings that are either transit friendly or they're very super auto-centric. Look at the Sunset District. Look at Richmond, look at areas near Daly City. They're almost akin to parts of Southern California. So, I mean, they're very much, shall we say, in a transit desert. You do have access to Muni, you have bus service, you have limited Muni rail coming through West Portal, of course, on the west side of Twin Peaks. But in reality, some of these areas are not necessarily not walkable, but not necessarily that frequent for transit riders in general. This is the baseline. So when we talk about whether or not Waymo service and other operator crews is going to be siphoning from Muni or BART or Caltrain or VTA, et cetera, well, we got to think of what was the original base case before. And then also, perhaps in this post-COVID environment where Muni ridership dropped, like, I don't know, 50 to 75% in some parts of San Francisco, over several years, and it's just barely recovering to pre-pandemic levels. It's an interesting time for us to kind of rethink what works and what doesn't in a range of areas. So what works in Noe Valley won't work in Marina or won't work in Potrero Hill. So it's just, I think that there's some possibilities taken in the right context, and then taking these learnings maybe through these programs that are integrations, credit programs, and seeing how it could either boost ridership or target this middle tier environment that I don't want to say they're on the fence, but they could go either direction, and there could be some value add without taking this very binary black and white approach, whether it's you're either a robotaxi customer or you're a public transit user who's been riding Muni for 50, 60 years, and that's it. There's a lot of nuance and a lot of gray, especially in a city like San Francisco. Which is quite different than my home city of Los Angeles. We can talk about that in a whole other discussion. But yeah, so I think that what you present is quite promising. And there's not one size fits all where you are residing right now, as well as maybe how that could scale to other US cities. So sorry with that. Sasha, what are your thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, I'm a product guy for more than 20 years, and if I've learned one thing in my career, then it's that the best product will win. So the most desirable product at a fair price will win the race. And I think what I witness in the public transport industry is a discussion around the structural inertia, particularly around line services. Why? That's how they earn money. That's how the operators get funded. That's how the cities plan. Line services is ultimately something that they consider as the only option that is desirable on roads. But we all know consumers don't. If people around the world hate one thing, then it's usually riding on large scale buses. If they have options to do otherwise, then they use them. And I think that's something that we need to understand and consider, that with the rise of robotaxi, and we are just at the beginning, the cost of operation for the operators is still high. The cost of the technology is tremendous. Once we get into an operation where the cost will be significantly lower per kilometer of a passenger than in a bus that is operated by a fleet operator, then we will see a strong disruption of the public transport. And I think now it's the time for the officials to dig the channels for the water to come. Otherwise, it will end up in an uncontrolled way, and then the usual reaction is to make it harder to use, to try to regulate and steer by forcing people into other direction. And I think that's not the wise way to get to a good adoption. One thing that Henry had mentioned, I would second that, is the use of pricing. Pricing can have a tremendous impact on customer choice. And that's what we see in our service here, where we use dynamic pricing to incentivize users to use our service on routes where we know there's a high chance for pooling because we already have a client on board and we know that there's high chance for getting another customer on board at basically no additional marginal costs. And that's a good thing. And I think we need to consider more of those kind of different options to make it more attractive to transport, as an example that transfer, as this example that Henriette has mentioned. But we should also witness the option to steer demand by the use of price, to use it into direction where traffic flows naturally, and provide better options. So ultimately, the accompanying effects that we talked about before, they get to a high level. What else is important from my point of view is that we see that a lot of the bus lines that are operated today, they are underutilized. So even in the city of Hamburg, there are bus lines running twice an hour that are utilized by two or three persons in average over the course of the whole week. And I think here, if we don't overcome the structural inertia of the current way of procuring services from city officials in bus lines and think about more flexible options, then we lose potential to get into more sustainable modes of operation by using autonomous smaller vehicles that will then be able to provide more flexible routes to consumers. So it has the potential to create win-win, but we need to start with the lines that are underutilized and offer a better service already today. And ultimately, I think we will anyhow end up in a world where bus lines will become more of BRT style, so bus rapid transit services, where you will have high capacity lines that will provide high quality of service, where it's worth to transfer because they are faster than using a robo taxi or a robo shuttle to get from A to B. And other than that, to get to your last destination, or where there is just naturally insufficient travel patterns to utilize high capacity vehicles, I guess we will see a lot more flexible movement, be it by robo taxis or robo shuttles.
It's certainly a true statement, and I agree with what you said, Sasha, about the trend towards BRT. We're seeing that with a significant investment, certainly of the previous Biden administration in the United States, with the unveiling of hundreds of different BRT lines throughout the United States, including Indianapolis Indigo, as well as many cities that were underserved with even fixed route. Now, the opportunity, though, is to link that with on-demand and perhaps improve upon more of the traditionalist urban planning of fixed route service, which is kind of it's that middle tier where it doesn't provide any of the benefits but all of the liabilities. And I think that we're moving in much more of, let's say, a 21st century paradigm now, albeit a bit north of Henriette right now. Perhaps Jarrett Walker in Portland, Oregon might disagree with what some of us are saying right now. But I would say, and I'm open to a wide range of viewpoints in terms of the role of BRT, DRT, as well as fixed route. And I think one size does not fit all for all cities. But there is a general trend towards dedicated bus rapid transit service, as well as flex service in feeders and transit deserts, et cetera. So it really should be, in my personal opinion, is just more of like a toolkit or toolbox where cities can kind of empower themselves and pick and choose what transit modules, to use cliche, can plug into their specific zones and neighborhoods that fit well, because it's not a one size fits all. And what works, again, as we well know in North America, does not work in Europe and vice versa. So we have to always keep that in mind and everything. But yeah, some really interesting insights there. So with our next topic. Let's go to you, Javier, around equity, accessibility, and citizen engagement, and the role of shared, not personal, but shared autonomous vehicles in that domain.
So, of course, when we think about the accessibility topic, both in terms of geographic accessibility and the people that can access these kind of services, it's difficult to attack the fully accessibility, the full accessibility all at once. So, it's important, in my opinion, to keep a work in progress. While not blocking the first deployments using autonomous vehicles. So when we take into account some of the people's particular needs in terms of accessibility, the service becomes much more difficult to be provided. Of course, it's where the impact is the higher, but this can also block some of the projects that can help keep improving the technology itself. That's something that, for example, we are also taking care of in the Ultimo project where we are now involved as partners. It's working on this kind of inclusive autonomous vehicles for everyone, taking care of the different needs. We have some workshops in Oslo, in Germany, and in Geneva to understand what are the things that need to be built over the standard basic transport service. But we cannot just wait for all this to be ready to start using autonomous vehicles. So I would say it's a parallel process. Once the technology is ready, we keep working on the passenger services, as I said before, and we keep building them to make sure that many people can use these services. This including not limiting them to having to being booked by smartphones, for example. We need to allow people to use these services even if they don't have a smartphone. Take into account that sometimes the ramp has to be open, sometimes not, and how this ramp is deployed. If some of the users need still to have a safety operator on board, it's of course interesting to reduce the operational cost or to try to optimize the operational cost. But there are some costs that are important to take into account, even if we are using autonomous vehicles. So maybe some of the vehicles need to have someone on board. That's not a driver anymore. It's someone that's going to help people get in, get out. So yeah, it's a very wide topic, and there are many projects, European projects, focusing on that, on this kind of discussions. But as I said, let's not wait to have the whole thing before starting to do something, because then we might not have anything at the end. So that's my comment on that.
No, thanks for. I love the example of people that do not have access to a smartphone. I mean, that's equity and accessibility right there in terms of technology. And that's a huge concern in the United States, the unbanked population, people that don't have a credit card or don't have a debit card. And how are they, what if they are only working in a cash-based economy? Obviously, this runs against maybe the mandates of a lot of regions and cities in terms of digitalizing, but we must not leave large sectors of the population, elderly and disadvantaged, behind in our march towards progress. And I think when we talk about, accessibility or lack of to a smartphone, or certain financial or banking services. These are strong considerations to consider, whether it be autonomy, whether it be mobility as a service, whether it be micromobility, anything that is kind of digitally connected. And I think it's something for us to give a little bit of deeper thought to. Again, like you mentioned, Javier, it's no reason for us to stop or wait, but it's a consideration that should be layered in and improved upon iterated over time. So yeah, Henrietta, you're in the US. Tell us about what's going on in this space right now.
Yeah, it's all the topic of equity accessibility is so since I moved here, I noticed it's very different approach than what I've all the work I've been doing before, being in Singapore or in Europe. And I'm still a bit struggling getting at the bottom of it. And I'll explain why. There is, and because I attended many conferences with local transit agencies, etc., there is a bit this tone that I'm still trying to find my way around it, put my head around it, that public transit is in the US very, very, very much for people who don't have any other mode of transport available, which when said like that, everybody would like you can only agree and say, oh, that's a great mission, right? Like you really see that as yeah, fantastic. You need that for people who can't afford a car, people with specific needs, etc. But over the time that I've been here, where I struggle with this, when you focus so much on that, is you don't take into account the entire, so to say, the entire population and the mass that inter, like when we are talking about public transport, it's really more like for everybody. And I like to speak about universal design. So of course you need a bus that is accessible, but it's not only for the wheelchair driver, it's actually better for everybody. And I like to put it this way, to not kind of feel that a service that is very slow, a service that is not efficient, that there is no frequency is kind of good enough for people who anyway don't have other choice. It's br a bit brutal the way I say it, but I perceive that. I really perceive that there is this mindset in terms of no, but we don't need to be that efficient because anyway, the people who use transit don't have a choice. And this actually I found brutal if I hear that. So I think that's not a good way to think about it. And I think everybody deserves a very efficient and come back to the fun factor, to convenience. Everybody need that. And if it means that you have very, very specific needs in terms of physical abilities or so on, maybe you need a very premium taxi limousine service with someone taking you and driving you all the way to your final destination. And it's your right, so to say. And the rest, the mass, will pay to have the service provided for very, very niche needs that cannot be covered with the mass transport. It opens, I know what I'm saying may open a lot of debate, because lately I heard someone from a local transit agency say, no, but people with special needs want to be integrated with everybody and ride the same services than everybody. And I would like to challenge this point, because I'm not sure that true that is true, based, for example, on discussion here in San Francisco with an association called the Lighthouse for the Blind, where the person said, like, this group were very, very supportive of robotaxi, because they were saying, you don't realize when you're blind, you have always kind of a chaperone with you. You lose your independence quite quickly, like if you're getting blind, or so you always rely on other people. And this idea of sitting alone in a vehicle, like when the person experienced that again, they say, you don't realize because you can drive alone in your car and you know how it is to put a podcast and be on your own and have your own thought, etc. But say, having that back, being in a robotaxi alone, that was a huge aspect. So I will challenge the idea of everybody needs to use the same system and we all need to share in terms of like being forced to it. I think it really depends on also like where you're coming from, and everybody. So my message would be, the equity will be really there when everybody can have from time to time premium services to move around, and they don't need to be automated. They don't need to be shared. It's a combination. But what we're talking about when we talk about public transit is really the mass of people, and that's where it should be really targeted. With this universal design in mind, of course, not excluding people. But yeah, I hope I was clear, because it may be a bit controversial the way I put it. And that's still something I'm working on and discussing with these various associations to get a better sense of what's right for everybody.
Well, you're speaking to an American here. So, yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. And it's really how we as a society or a collective or a commonwealth view the role of public transport, or as we Americans say, public transit. Is it a necessity? Is it a utility? Is it an amenity? Or is it all the above? And what role does it play in society? Is it the bare minimum, bare bones, as we're mentioning? Or is it more than that? And is it just natural and seamless? Like my experience, but I don't mean to name drop, but my experience in several European cities, especially in Berlin, when I ride the bus or I ride the U-Bahn, it's natural, it's seamless. There's no friction. So it's not even a struggle. It's just you basically transport from one mode or one zone to the next, and it's experience across all sectors of society, old, young, socioeconomic, etc. And that's when you know that public transport, whether it's autonomous, whether it's technologically enabled, whether it's fixed route or whether it's on demand, serves that greater societal role versus the bare minimum. So again, we can explore that in another conversation. It is very controversial, but that's at the heart of the cultural DNA of what we're talking about, at least in the US. So, but yes, that's exactly what you're mentioning. But Sasha, what are your thoughts on the topic of kind of equity and shared autonomy?
I think the answer that I might give might sound a bit contradictory in total. The first thing is we realized that in a lot of discussion, the focus is when we speak about accessibility is on the wheelchair accessibility of the vehicles. And by doing so, we forget about all the other aspects of accessibility and the benefit that the services can provide to users with other forms of disabilities. To give you one example, we operate in Hamburg, and 20% of our users are people with severe disabilities. Only around 1 to 2% of those require a wheelchair. The discussion is all around the wheelchair. We operate 5% of our fleet as a mixed fleet with wheelchair accessible vehicles. 95% of our fleet are not accessible, but they are accessible for everyone else. For people who are blind, who have mental disabilities, we get so tremendously positive feedback because for them, it's a huge benefit in life that they can get from A to B without transfers, that they have an app that is optimized for lack of visibility or hearing. And giving them also for people with mental disabilities, removing the struggle of transfers, removing the struggle of dealing with ticket systems, with cash in vehicles. This is just a tremendous uplift. And I think in the overall discussion, we need to make sure that we look at the broader picture and make sure that we don't focus too much of the wheelchair accessibility. At the same time, I think we need to focus on those user groups when we design the vehicles and the services. That's why we included PinPad in the outside. So you don't need a smartphone to authenticate if you can't afford it. We included microphone and speakers outside of the vehicle, so you're able to guide people, but also to authenticate and make sure that the people get into the right vehicle if they're not able to spot a number on the vehicle. So if you get in high density areas with a lot of vehicles, you need to make sure that people who are blind or maybe blind and deaf end up in the right vehicle. And that's super crucial. So you need to consider all those design elements and build the services with don't just these kind of limitations in mind. As we did so, we tried to integrate wheelchairs into our autonomous vehicles, and we did a lot of co-creation and design. And there's two main reasons why we weren't able to come up with a solution so far. The one is lack of standards for wheelchair. We just don't have proper means to fix the wheelchair into the vehicle to comply to regulatory requirements. In a city bus, it's a different regulatory framework. In a passenger car, it's from our point of view, without standardization on the wheelchair, it's barely impossible with all the technological solution that we have found. And the second thing is that you limit the capabilities of those kind of services in the overall system, because we will not be able to fit in a ramp or safe to allow safe onboarding that meets the requirements of a door-to-door or stop-to-stop service other than those who would only facilitate the bus stops. And then you don't provide any additional real benefit to those with wheelchairs if you require them to get to bus stops. So this again would limit the potential of those kind of services. That's why we think for the beginning, what we try to advocate for is a use the robotaxis, specifically designed robotaxis that keep the requirements of people with disabilities in mind. Don't focus only on the wheelchair accessible vehicles. Provide them as a mixed fleet with human drivers, and just use the potential that you have and the willingness to pay of your passengers by not by by using higher prices due to the higher comfort of those services that those services can provide, to then be able to subsidize for equity and for accessibility and for mixed fleet with wheelchairs.
Great. And I just realized we're running out of time here. I don't want to take up more time, but I want to thank you all. We're going to be sharing the links with everyone. This is live stream, but this will be recorded and available on Spotify, Amazon, Apple, etc. It'll be also available UMX, EIT, Urban Mobility. I'm sure probably at Moya and Padam as well too, and everyone can follow Sasha, Henriette, and Javier on their LinkedIn pages as well as other social media. And we'll include that in links that we'll probably have posted and published early next week, although everyone's been able to see the live stream now. And then I just want to also have a shout out to once again UMX. So big thanks to UMX for sponsoring again this episode. And if you want to learn more about UMX, check out their catalog of 40 plus courses, expert videos, and in-person trainings at urbanmobilitycourses.eu. They even have a short course on today's topic, which we included in the chat and the comments. You can find it there on autonomous vehicles. And stay tuned as we will have another course review on the city's first podcast and the city's first advisors, as well as a webinar towards the end of July, where we'll be focused on micromobility and cities, which is our next topic. But with that, I really want to thank sincerely Henriette, Sasha, and Javier all for your time today. It's been a sincere pleasure. I learned a lot. I always like to have this transatlantic perspective, which is a lot of fun. And I think we're at a really exciting time now, even much more exciting than when a lot of the peak hype started in 2017, 2018. And we're really pushing towards some very concrete use cases. And I think it's much more interesting for users, cities, and others to really start testing this out and understanding the value of shared, again, shared AVs, not personal AVs, which is the theme and the emphasis for today's webinar. But thank you once again, everyone, for your time. And yeah, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.